Quantum gravity signals in cosmology and gravitational waves. The question which I would like to address is, can quantum gravity theories leave a signal in astrophysical cosmological observations and gravitational wave detections? The reason for asking this question is twofold. There are several quantum gravity theories, given here in an alphabetical order, ADS-CFT, asymptotically safe gravity, causal sets, dynamical triangulations, profile theory, loop quantum gravity and spin forms, matrix and tensor models, non-commutative geometry, or string theory. And the question is whether any of them is the correct theory. To answer this question, you need not only to check the consistency of the theory itself, but to see whether it can explain the universe in which we live. So by testing predictions of these theories, the results you will get will either support or disfavor the quantum gravity theory you have been considering. There's a caveat here that one has to keep in mind, though, that actually you don't test the full theory, but the cosmological model inspired from the theory. On the other hand, there are still questions about both early and late universe, which have not been resolved. The initial singularity cannot be resolved within the classical theory. There are endless papers in inflation. But it remains a paradigm in search of a theory. What does it lead the universe to the currently accelerated expansion? We don't know. There are many experiments looking for dark matter. We still don't know. We have constructed in cosmology a phenomenological model within GR, the Lambda CDM model, to explain the data. But this is a consistency kind of check. The model is built to be in agreement with the data. So in this presentation I will give, I will try to convince you that yes, quantum gravity theory can leave a signal in astrophysical cosmological observations and gravitational wave detections. There's of course no way that I can cover all these quantum gravity theories and their predictions. I will just constrain myself in a few among the ones I have been playing with in order to highlight this answer to the question that motivated this study. So let me start with string brain theory and extra dimensions. Let me consider a compactified 3+1 dimensional brain, which propagates in a higher dimensional bulk populated by point-like particles. The particles, zero dimensional brains. In other words, all special dimensions are wrapped around compact space. One of the three-dimensional brains could be my universe. So as the brain universe moves in the back, the particles cross it. But the brain is nothing else but the collection of the own points of open strings. So you have particle excitations, open strings, to propagate in a medium of the particles. So the particles can be captured by the matter open strings. And therefore, as this interaction will take place, the particle will recoil. That means that we'll have the emergence of the vector-like excitation. So locally, Lorentz invariance is broken, and this vector-like excitation can lead to an era of inflation and contribute to large-scale structure and galaxy formation. So this kind of natural way of getting this vector field is like motivates, if you wish, the vector field that was put by hand in the Tevis model of Bekenstein. So it's there. Here as well, I have a biometric theory. I have a sigma model background metric related to the Einstein frame and a metric describing the distortion of space-time surrounding the D particles. So let's break down the effective low energy field theory for the graviton, the dilaton, which is assumed to be constant, the vector field moving in my background. The vector field, just the recoil velocity excitation during the string and D particle interactions with the string F mu nu. The calligraphic G mu nu is the flux gauge field. T3 is a brain tension. Small g is the determinant of the gravitational field. 1 over k squared is the four-dimensional bulk induced gravitational constant, and the A prime and A are related, as a matter of fact, to the shrink scale. Now, having this action, and write the equations of motion for both graviton, dilaton, and as well for the vector field. And let me consider first late eras. And there, I will consider that the D particles have the conical hostings which obey Gaussian statistics. So macroscopically, Lorentz invariance is maintained. And I will denote the statistical values of the recoil velocity by beta. And as you can see from this static relation, the statistical fluctuations are proportional to the cosmic density of the vector. First thing I want to do, I want to find what is the value of beta so that the particles play the role of dark matter candidates. So I have to go and write the expression for the deflection of light. I have various gravitational lensing data. So from the graviton equation, I can find the constraint on the statistical variance of the recoil velocity so that the D particles can provide the dark matter. And if I fix the string scale to 10 to the 4 GeV, this is the upper bound that I get for beta. I can also find the constraint if I want these D particles to have a density such that you can have a growing mode of your matter perturbations. In other words, when you're going to write down the perturbation equations, you will see that the magnitude of the variance of the recoil velocity plays a very important role in allowing matter density perturbations to go sufficiently to lead to structure formation. So I have a bound, a minimum density of the particle, and actually by fixing the string scale to the 10 to the 4th GeV, you get a constraint on the brain tension. Now, this mechanism can also give a contribution to the dark energy, because you have neutrinos in your model, which are like dark matter candidates that could be captured from the D particles. But the new string matter excitation which you get after the capture by the D particle defect might be different, have different flavor than what it had before. So you would expect that in galaxies where you might have populations of D particles, it's like if you had a medium that induced flavor oscillations between an electron and a neutrino, for instance. So if you go to compute the average of the neutrino stress tensor with respect to the flavor vacuum, you find that neutrino mixing is going to give a 24% contribution to the omega lambda. What about inflation? There are two regimes that could lead to inflation: large condensated fields and small condensated fields, which depends whether the string scale is low or has a high value with respect to the Hubble during inflation. And it happens that only the former case of low string scale is compatible with Planck data, which actually makes sense because we have dense populations in the early universe and these particles are diluted later. So if you go to fix the spectral index, you find about 60 number of faults, it's good, and you have slow parameters, which are slow roll parameters, which are agreement with what they should be, much smaller than one. What you get here is a kind of Starobinsky type inflation. So this model motivated from large extra dimensions seems to pass the various tests that we have done so far. Now, what is the current situation in the string theory with respect to cosmology? It's what is called the string swamp land. It's something I have not work myself, but it's worth going through that to see what is the current status today. The idea here is going to distinguish effective field theories which can be completed into quantum gravity in the UV from those which cannot. So here there is a schematic illustration of the space of self-consistent effective quantum field theories. The subset which could arise from string theory is the string landscape, while all other theories are in the string swampland. So the string swampland is the effective field theories that cannot be completed into quantum gravity in the UV. So this is a scale, the swampland scale, at which effective field theories must be modified if it is to be able to be completed into quantum gravity theory in the UV. Here you have a schematic interpretation of that. So there are different kinds of scales on an effect field theory. The first here, scales, this green one, is the pure quantum field theory, with just one cut. The second one, you have a quantum field theory with gravity, with the parameter values such that the scale of the Schoenflat is bigger than the scale of the quantum field theory. You have the third case, where you have a strong constraint on effective field theory due to gravity. And you have the last full red case here, where this theory is inconsistent already at the lowest non-trivial energy scale of the theory. Now, various conjectures have been proposed. I'm not going to go through all of them, but I'd like to highlight the ones which are relevant for what I wanted to focus more on. The first is the Schoenflat distance conjecture, which is an upper bound of the rate traversed by the scalar field. So the idea is here that if you have a quantum gravity theory coupled to scalars described by an effective Lagrangian, this one will be valid up to given cutoff. And there is a finite radius in your field space where this effective Lagrangian is valid. Above that, there is a tower of light modes which invalidates the effective Lagrangian. The second conjecture is the De Sitter conjecture, which has a lower bound of the derivatives of the scalar potential with respect to the scalar fields. This conjecture arises from the fact that it's difficult to construct a metastable De Sitter vacuum in string theory. And let me also mention the third conjecture, the Transplaquian censorship conjecture, which comes from the idea that in a consistent quantum theory of gravity, Sublagian quantum fluctuations should remain quantum and never become bigger than the Hubble horizon and freeze in an expanding unit. So there are three unknown parameters, C and delta, which have to be close to one. The question is, which are the cosmological implications that one can deduce from that? Due to that, let me consider a slow roll single field deflation and write the relation between the equation of state and the number of free falls. In terms of this parameter k, which is one for exponential power law potential, and two for fine-tuned plateau models like Higgs deflation or Starobinic deflation. If you go to calculate the range of phi during the last defaults, you will see that it's bigger than something of the order one. And if you take all possible factors into account, it's bigger than something about five. So there is a contradiction with the distance conjecture. And if you take the case of fine-tuned plateau models, the more tension becomes even stronger. Now let me go and take the beta mode polarization and write the tensor to scalar fluctuations amplitude. Then from the data which you have, you see that for both exponential power law potential or for fine-tuned plateau, there is a tensor with the desisted conjecture. Actually, for Higgs deflation, Starobinsky deflation, this tension, it is, again, strong. So one then has to ask, are Schoenflat conjectures wrong? Or is inflation wrong, at least cannot be accommodated within string theory? Let me go now to the late universe, dark energy, the current accelerated expansion. There are two ways that you could explain it, either a cosmological constant or a dynamical dark energy, like quintessence. Well, the De Sitter conjecture, the Transplaquian conjecture, tells you that the first case is not possible, so you are left with the case of a dynamical dark energy. So here I give a plot of the dark energy equation of state with respect to tau, actually with respect to redshift in this case. The black line corresponds to the 2 sigma bound based on supernova, cosmic microwave background, or baryon acoustic oscillations. For different values of this constant lambda, and you can clearly see that there is an upper limit of lambda to be above 0.6, which means that C is smaller than 0.6, which means that you have any compatibility with C to be of the order of 1. Of course, here there is some kind of ambiguity. What does it mean of the order, about the order 1? Nevertheless, the challenge for strict theory here is to construct a model with C smaller or around 0.6, consistent with quantum gravity and not being in the swamplet. Let me now change gears and go to an operative approach to quantum gravity, group field theory and group field cosmology. So the idea here is that space-time and geometry should be emerged as an effective description of the collective behavior of different pre-geometric fundamental degrees of freedom. There are studies which support the idea that there is a phase transition which separates a symmetric from a broken condensate phase as the mass parameter changes its sign to negative values in the infrared limit of the theory. And from this group field theory approach, you get the group field theory quantum cosmology, which has as a goal to model homogeneous, continuum three geometries and their cosmological evolution by means of GFT condensate states and their effective dynamics. The conjecture here is that there is a phase transition in a group field theory system which gives rise to a condensate phase. This approach is suitable to model spatially homogeneous geometries whose metric is the same at every point of the space emerging from the condensate. Now, whatever I'm going to say here, it's valid for a group field theory model where the local gauge group of gravity says you do. The elementary building block of three-dimensional space is a quantum tetrahedron. And then I'm going to specify my theory by choosing a field and its axiom for the dynamics. And as such, I take a complex scalar field, and the axiom will be given by a kinetic quadratic term and the sum of interaction potential at polynomials weighted by coupling constants. So here is the axiom for the complex scalar field sigma, which represents the configuration of the condensate of my GFT quanta as a function of a massless scalar field, which plays the role of relational time. And I split my complex scalar field in terms of its modulus, rho, and its phase, theta. J is the spin representation of the SU2. And this volume V is the elementary volume determined by the chosen SU2 representation. Actually, it's nothing else than the largest eigenvalue of the LQG volume operator for a spin network node with four links labeled by J. And since we have shown that a free condensate configuration in an isotropic restriction settles dynamically into a low spin configuration of the quantum geometry, I'm going to consider just one spin and I'm going to drop the index J. So now, if I assume that interactions between the GFT quanta are subdominant, I can write the effective Friedmann equation in the semi-classical limit. It's the evolution equation in the classical limit of group theory. This equation is valid under the assumption that the cosmological state in quantum gravity is well approximated by a simple condensate that ignores connectivity formation, that the quantum geometry in the condensate are considered isotropic, and the interaction term is subdominant. So there is an effective gravitational constant from the collective behavior of space-time quanta, and here I give you its behavior as a function of this relational time phi. Asymptotically, for large values of phi, it coincides with the Newton's constant. For both positive and negative GFT energy, there is a bounce which replaces the classical singularity. In the bound, the energy density goes to a maximum value and the volume to a minimum value, the volume at the bounds. Next question here is, can I have a kind of accelerated expansion without putting my hand in the Eflatun field and its potential? So here I wrote down the corresponding condition for inflation in the absence of a classical space-time and absence of proper time. And you see that this condition is indeed satisfied near the bounds, when m squared enters in the question of motion for the condensate and can be expressed in terms of the GFD coefficients. But it's not really sufficient to have inflation. Deflation should last long enough. So I have to define the number of folds, and I can see how many folds I can have. This will depend on the interaction time. So here is again the effective action for an isotropic GFD condensate. If you forget interactions, then the number of folds is zero. You have to turn on the interactions, and the reactions should be of a particular form so that to have sufficient number of folds. So what I learned here is that I need to group my quantum geometry in a particular way so that inflation to be acceptable. So this is important because we get some information about model building, and now we can see if indeed the full theory can naturally accommodate such interaction terms. Now let me move to something else, to non-commutative spectral geometry. Now, this is a bottom-up approach to quantum gravity, where we're going to guess the small-scale stacks of space-time from the knowledge we have in electroweak scales when all the particle physics experiments take place. Here there is a very clear difference from what we said in the different other models before. The idea is that to construct a quantum gravity theory coupled to matter, gravity-matter interactions is the most important ingredient for the dynamics. You cannot neglect that. You cannot put it out of experiment. And the idea is that if you are in very high energy scales, space-time is wildly non-commutative. But if you are lower than the Planck, but close to that, then the algebra of coordinates is only mildly non-commutative. And if you algebra, and if you particularly suitably choose it, then you can get the standard model of particle physics coupled to gravity. So the standard model here is a phenomenological model which is going to dictate the space-time geometry. So my geometry is a product for the dimensional manifold, compact Riemannian manifold, and the finite non-commutative space. So I have a four-dimensional space-time with an internal Kaluza-Klein line attached to each point, with a fifth dimension being a discrete zero-dimensionality space. And this product geometry is given by spectral triple, the algebra of coordinates, the Hilbert space, and the Dirac operator. And the important thing is the action, spectral action principle, which tells me that action function depends only on the spectrum of the generalized Dirac operator. It actually sums up all the eigenvalues of the Dirac operator smaller than the given cutoff. You evaluate that in the using heat kernel techniques, and if you are going to do an asymptotic expansion in the energy scale, then you have this very simple fold with three parameters, the F4, F2, and F0, and I'm going to put constraints on F0, which has to do with the Kaplan's concept at unification from astrophysical data. So basically what I do is I'm going to consider linear perturbations around the Minkowski background. I write down the special components of the H mu in the far field limit in terms of the Bessel functions and in terms of the second derivative of the quadruple moment. Beta is a parameter which is related to F0. So then by writing the quadruple formula, I can calculate the energy loss to gravitational radiation by orbiting binaries. And then, considering that the magnitude of the deviations from GR must be less than the accuracy to which the rate of change of the orbital period agrees with the general relativity predictions, I can put constraint on beta, in other words, on F0, which relates the coupling constant at unification. Considering geodesic and frame tracking effects of GR, the data from the cavity probe B and the Laris experiments could give a yet stronger limit on beta, therefore on F0. And finally, by making the remark that the modification to the Newtonian potential, the Bardeen potential, which you get, are similar to those induced by the fifth force. Using torsion balance, we could give a much stronger constraint on F0. So it's very interesting. It's quite cool, actually, that from astrophysical data, we were able to put constraint on a mathematical construction so that at the electroweak scale, we have standard model coupled to gravity. Now let me discuss the last part, quantum gravity gravitational waves. So if you have quantification of GR, then you're going to have differences in both generation and propagation of gravitational waves. I cannot address the first question in terms of time. I'm going just to go to how the propagation of gravitational waves may be altered. Now, it's actually very nice that even with the one binary neutron star merchant, which we had observed, the GW170817, accompanied 1.7 seconds afterwards by gamma ray observation, we were able to put constraints on the dimensionality of space-time. That is very simple. We're going to have tamping of the waveform due to gravitational leakage into extra dimensions. This deviation depends on the number of dimensions and would result to a systematic overestimation of the source electromagnetic luminosity distance inferred from gravitational wave data. So if you go to compare the strain measured in a gravitational wave interferometer with the luminosity distance measured from the optical counterpart, you could constrain the number of space-time dimensions, and then from just one data set of the GW170817, the like collaboration were found consistency with general relativity in four dimensions, and some others like the DGP model was ruled out. Let me continue along this line and ask again the question. Can you see quantum gravity corrections gravitational waves? And if you ask this question, the first answer that one is going to come up is forget it. Quantum gravity corrections are going to be suppressed by the Planck scale. If you write down the Einstein-Hilbert axiom and you try to find perturbative corrections, you have two scales to play with, the Planck scale and the Hubble. So whatever constraint you might put is going to be, a correction you might put is going to be completely Planck suppressed. But the answer might be different in case you have a third scale. And indeed, there's a long-range non-perturbative mechanism which is found in most quantum gravity candidates, the dimensional plot, change of space-time dimensionality. So this action here gives the way that space-time is distorted by quantum gravity effects, characterized by space-time measure rho, which tells me how the volume are going to change, and you have a kinetic term K, which actually is the one that leads to modified dispersion relations. And I've written that for a generic source term J. There are two scales which appear here, the characteristic scale of the geometry L star, and the scaling parameter gamma, which depends on the spectral dimension, which is governed by the kinetic term, and the Hausdorff dimension, which tells me how the volume change with the linear size. Now, whatever I'm doing here, I'm just concentrating myself in the spin 2 gravitational sector. So here's the way that shows how the gravitational wave amplitude is determined by the convolution of the source with a retarded Green function. Now, this relation can be written into the subsequent form here, in radial coordinates and the local wave zone. And the key point that one has to keep here is that the gravitational wave amplitude is the product of a dimensionless function, f, and the power law distance behavior. So let me absorb the redshift factors and all details of the source into this dimensionless f, and then this is the relations for the gravitational wave amplitude. This relation, however, is only valid for a plateau in the dimensional flow. And in a couple of transparencies later, I'm going to write this expression in a general form for all scales. Now, in the literature, you can find the value of the scaling parameter gamma for different quantum gravity proposals. And the values depend on the two regimes. The UV regime, where quantum gravity corrections are important, which here is denoted with the red color, and the mesoscopic regime, where intermediate scales are taken into account, meaning that are scales where the corrections to GR may be small, but they by no means be neglected. Now, the last column here shows theories with a near infrared parameter, gamma mesoscopic, greater than about 1. So, the relation now that gives me the gravitational wave amplitude in terms of these scales, gamma and L star that I gave before, and holds for all possible scales. It is written here in this blue box, the second relation. And as you can see, it has a form which is similar to the one that we had before in the case of extra dimensions. So I can again relate, compare the strength as measured from interferometer and the luminosity distance as measured from the optical counterpart of the standard siren. So if there is only one fundamental scale, the Planck scale, the equation is exact and the gamma is the gamma UV. If there is a mesoscopic scale, the equation is valid only near the infrared regime and the gamma becomes the mesoscopic gamma of the order of 1. So actually, theories beyond GR can change both the dispersion relation of gravitational waves and the background metric solutions. And we can encode these effects into the ratio between gravitational wave and electromagnetic luminosity distance at any redshift. So observations can plan constraints, can put constraints on these parameters, lambda, L star, and gamma, in a model independent way by constraining the ratio between gravitational waves and electromagnetic luminosity distance as a function of the redshift of the source. The data we have been using is the GW170817 and a simulated supermassive black hole merger within the laser detectability. The results are the following. When the gamma is the UV scale, you cannot constrain the deep UV limit of quantum gravity because your scale is the Planck scale. This, of course, makes sense. Deviations from classical geometry occur at microscopic scales and there are no observable in astrophysics. The only theories which you can constrain in this way are those for which the microscopic scale is bigger than the UV scale. And the only quantum gravity theories which enter into this class are group field theory, spin forms, and quantum gravity. And the constraint which we get is here, gamma mesoscopic, minus one should be smaller than 0.02. A stronger limit you could get if you take the Cassini bound, becomes smaller than 10 to the minus 5, but then you have to keep in mind that this constraint from the Cassini bound, it relies on model-dependent assumptions on the scalar sector, independent of the arguments of propagation of the spin to gravitational waves we took here. Now, there is something that I would like to point out here. By no means I say that GFT, spin forms, and LQG are the correct theories. No, I'm saying these are the only ones which could generate a signal detectable the standard size. And then the next thing that one should do is to look for realistic quantum states of geometry, giving rise to such a signal. And now let me go to my conclusions. So what I have tried to do here is I have considered cosmological models built on quantum gravity theories, either from strings and extra dimensions or from GFT or from non-commutative geometry, to show that one can come up with mechanisms to explain observations for which ad hoc phenomenological models have been proposed, having in mind inflation and the lambda CDM model. On the other hand, astrophysical observations and gravitational wave detections offer tests to support or disfavor a quantum gravity theory, and in some cases also assist in one interpretation. Thank you very much.